Hey everybody, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of This Is 40 by my favorite Christmas gift, Erica Bromley.
How you doing? Merry Christmas, everyone.
Today is Christmas Day, if you celebrate that day or recognize that day.
Christmas.
And we're talking about This Is 40. We're going to talk mostly spoiler-free because it's a new movie and we want people to be able to listen to the show to decide whether or not they want to see it.
I never agreed to this.
You can talk I will just redact your conversation. So it'll go a little bit like this. I thought this about This Is 40. What did you think?
Spoiler.
I'm just going to beep over you. I'm not going to actually add a beeping sound effect. I'm literally just going to say the word beep anytime you talk.
Okay.
It sounds prettier when you do it. Everything's prettier when you do it. So you can find our website. Are you warmed up now? Are you all?
Yeah.
Are you ready to go?
Work on my voice.
You can find our website at fthismovie.net. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. And email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
You know, I like you on Facebook, and I like you in real life.
Thank you so much.
I like you right now.
Wow. Nothing's real unless it's on Facebook.
That's true. It didn't happen.
My mind is blown. So, like I said, we're going to be talking about This Is 40, the new movie from Judd Apatow. You know, the first time I saw the trailer for the movie, it's the sort of sequel to Knocked Up, as the marketing puts it. And I barf in my mouth. But the first time I saw the trailer, it was like, oh, this is a movie about being married. And I thought, well, who better to do a podcast about it with than Doug? But then Doug was like, Christmas, dude, what are you talking about? So I went with...
We're married.
No. Yeah. And like listen, you make a great second choice for the podcast, not for marriage.
Oh, okay.
First choice in marriage.
Okay.
Second choice for podcast.
Doug! Some people would say that Doug was your first choice in marriage.
Some people would say that.
Yeah.
Some people might even be right. So we actually saw this movie a while ago.
We did.
Because we are cool. And we were going to try and get the podcast up a little bit early. That ended up not happening. A, because we thought, well, let's wait till it's out and people could see it. And B, who has time to record a podcast?
Christmas.
Around Christmas. Christmas. Before we talk about This Is 40, though, we have to talk about the other stuff we've seen lately.
Okay, we just watched a movie called Sleepwalk With Me.
Yes.
And it was written by Mike Birbiglia.
Yes.
And it stars Mike Birbiglia.
Directed by?
Mike Birbiglia.
That's right.
I like to say Birbiglia.
Catered by?
Mike Birbiglia.
No, I'm sorry. Tasty Catering.
Oh.
Tasty Catering.
They do a lot of work.
They do.
Yeah.
Well, their food is decent.
Decent.
Decent, I guess.
So we watched Sleepwalk With Me, and I really liked it. I can't stop thinking about it. So there. I really liked it. It's about Mike Birbiglia's life. I knew very little about it. Patrick knew a little more than me because he knows all the stuff about comedians. And Mike Birbiglia is a stand-up, right?
Correct.
And he does a lot of work for NPR?
Yes.
Okay. And he had a sleepwalking...
I think Ira Glass was a producer on the movie.
Okay. He not had, but he still has, right? It's not cured.
Yeah.
But he has a sleepwalking disorder, actually like the most severe one that you can have, right?
I guess. I don't know if the movie makes that explicit.
Okay.
In terms of like a line of dialogue that says, you have the most severe sleeping disorder. Maybe
right.
They do.
Well,
but
they kind of,
based on what you see in the movie, you have to think like, oh, this is as bad as it gets, right?
I think that there was either a doctor or maybe he was...
Do you know what? I was on my iPod.
You were?
Yeah. I don't have an iPad.
Okay.
But I put in my earbuds
okay.
and I was listening to...
It's like a lot of stuff that's really important.
Yeah. I mean, I was listening to This American Life, so it's like I was participating.
That's way smarter than some other things you could have been doing.
I like to multitask. and multitisk.
I'm pretty sure that they said that his form of the sleeping disorder was the most severe, and it could be very dangerous. Like, am I giving too much away?
I wouldn't give away, but it can be very dangerous.
It can be very dangerous, yeah. And the movie, I kept asking Patrick throughout the...
No, you were trying so hard not to spoil it, and I just came right out with it.
I kept asking Patrick through the movie, like, is this real? Did this happen to him?
And I'm like, no, this is a movie.
A few of the things that were major things, Patrick said that, yes, he had heard him talk. He had heard Mike Birbiglia when they went out for coffee a couple times.
Well, it's based on, like, a one-man show that he did called Sleepwalk With Me, which was very successful. He performed it, like, off-Broadway and turned it into a movie. So
some of you may know, if you've listened before, or if you know me in real life, which is probably, like, 98% of the listeners. just kidding.
You get around, I guess, is what you're saying.
What?
I don't mean sexually. I just mean you know a lot of people.
Yeah.
Also,
totally
you're a little
popular.
Slutty, but I don't.
What?
I mean it in the nicest way.
Some people. Now I lost my train of thought.
Of course you did.
Because we were thinking about, you know, getting around.
people that know that you like movies about relationships.
Yes, I do. And I like movies where people walk and talk about relationships. Walk and
or talk sleepwalk and talk about
yes,
relationships.
Yes, right. So this worked. No, I thought the movie was really honest about life. Like, about relationships, about how people sometimes do the wrong thing, but not because they mean to hurt someone or because they... I don't know, even mean to at all. Like, sometimes you just go along with something that is happening around you. And so maybe that was, like, supposed to be a metaphor. He wasn't just sleepwalking when he was sleeping. He was sleepwalking through life.
I think you just cracked that code.
Oh, my
right?
gosh.
Crazy, right? And it would be, like, kind of a heavy-handed metaphor if you didn't know that he actually suffers from sleepwalking.
Right. So there was a lot of honest dialogue and just...
But yes. It's also a movie about, like, the process of becoming a stand-up and having to do horrible gigs and not having enough material and opening for somebody.
And I love that kind of stuff, too. Yeah. So I love the relationship stuff. I love all that, like, kind of following your dream and all the crap you have to do to get there, to get to be successful or semi-successful. And, yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah. So I'll put you
on. He was very likable.
He was, yeah. Well, that's kind of
even
what he
when
going.
He's but not likable.
I could imagine that there's a lot of people who will not like him. He has a very specific sort of stammery style and a very sort of mannered way of talking at times.
Right.
And I think it will rub a lot of people the wrong way.
He feels to me like someone everyone knows, or like everyone knows someone kind of like him.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you who in my life would be that person. Maybe I don't then. Maybe I'm totally wrong. I don't know.
You just blew holes in
my mind. Maybe it's because
theory.
There was just so much to relate to, even though I didn't necessarily relate to a lot of it. I just felt like it was real. I felt like it was honest. I don't know. I liked it a lot.
Good. Let me put you on the spot. We're coming up on the end of the year. There's about a week left, right?
No,
in the
I'm
year,
not answering
in 2012.
This question.
I'm just going to ask.
No.
Because
no.
you're going to be publishing your 10 best list soon on ifthismovie.net. Do you think this movie earns a spot?
It's only been how long since we saw it?
Like 24 hours.
Well, I've thought about it a lot in 24 hours.
Exactly.
So it might make its way. It would definitely be an honorable mentions. Definitely.
All right.
Because I still have an honorable mention section. I don't think anyone else does.
No. We all commit to 10.
Yeah. Nope.
Not
nope.
you.
Nope.
Afraid of committing. That's why you like the movie so much. Should we talk about the other movie? It's available on Netflix Instant. If you are somebody who subscribes to that, you should watch it. Came out a couple months
really
ago.
Should. And you know what?
Oh my God.
I don't know if this is true or not, so somebody tell me. But I heard a rumor that The Wire is now available on Netflix Instant. If this is true, you should turn off the podcast right now and just watch The Wire. No, wait, don't go. Watch The Wire later.
And for the record, nobody has to tell Erica. If we could just look it up.
Oh, okay.
It would take a really long time for us to wait to hear back from somebody.
Well, I'm sure.
I'm more of a Bing man. We still have a couple hours left in Christmas.
Okay.
Two more movies that we need to talk about quickly. Okay. Another one that we watched on Netflix Instant, a documentary called Clean Flicks.
Oh.
Which is about sort of this early 2000s movement spearheaded in the Mormon community.
Which I had no idea about.
And I remember it from the director's sort of upheaval. A lot of directors were speaking out against it.
But years later, right? In 2000 or 2001, did you have any idea this was going on?
No, but I think it said that these directors like started publishing their letter and stuff in like 03, 04, and I think I knew about that.
Okay.
Steven Soderbergh was the one who I really remember speaking out against it.
Yeah.
So some Mormons in the early 2000s, perhaps jealous of those who get to watch rated R movies, because apparently it's not okay for the Mormons, decided to just take all the rated R movies that they want to see and edit out all of the dirty bits and the objectionable parts, the violence and the nudity and the sex. And then sell or rent their edited copies of those movies.
And they felt that this was okay because they bought the discs. So if they bought one disc and edited one disc and then sold that disc, it was like their own thing that they did with what they bought.
So it's not infringing on copyright law. It's an insane movie because for so much of it, you're just so frustrated. Like, how did this not get shut down sooner?
Right away. If a guy walked up to you on the street and said, I've got this.
It's legal if a guy's selling a bootleg on the street.
Right.
So I don't know if it has to do with the Mormon church being behind it, and maybe copyright lawyers can't get involved. I don't know.
A lot of power.
You wonder how it goes on for so long, and you're just amazed at like these people see nothing. There's such a hypocrisy. Like,
right.
What we're doing is right, even though what we're doing is illegal. We believe it's right because it's our right to see the Matrix. Like, no, it isn't.
Right.
And if it is, then watch the rated R one that the filmmakers made.
You could fast forward to the parts.
You know, so many of the filmmakers, with good reason, that there are the argument they were standing behind is like, no one has the right to change my art, and that's true. I agree with that, but like, that would be the second argument I make. The first one would be like, it's illegal. Stop doing what you're doing.
Right.
But then the documentary very slowly, one specific guy. I don't want to give too much away, but one specific guy who keeps the business going even after he's told he can't.
And, like, gets shut down and opens again.
Begins to come into focus, and the movie takes some very interesting turns. Yeah. So, not a great documentary, but definitely worth watching, especially if you're a movie fan.
Right. It was fascinating, I thought. And at one point, someone says, I think one of the rival stores, that guy, I think, eventually got shut down, and he kind of said, well, I'm not going to continue doing something that's illegal.
Right.
I don't know how I put it.
He kind of was the one who finally articulated the hypocrisy of the whole thing.
Right. Like, they don't want to see what they think is bad, but they're willing to commit a crime.
Right. Certain movies, by the way, can't be edited.
Right.
Pretty Woman, because it's based on being a prostitute, and Brokeback Mountain. Because,
they
wouldn't
even. Well, they
gays didn't, are ewy.
Yeah, they said we're not even going to go there or something like that.
It's just a laugh. Mormons. And then the last movie that I think we should talk about is a movie that came out today in theaters.
It did,
and that is Les Misérables.
Yeah,
Les Misérables. Tom Hooper's Academy Award winning director, Tom Hooper's take on the famous Broadway musical. This is a crazy movie because
I don't know
people
how to talk
are,
about it.
Yeah. Are like out of their minds, excited to see it. Reviews are coming in. Some people love it. It's ending up on 10 best lists. I've seen it on at least one respected film critic's 10 worst list. I think that's a little bit maybe reactionary.
Right, sure.
Having said that, there's very little about the movie that I can say I liked.
Yeah.
And most of it, honestly, comes down to every single choice that Tom Hooper made. A conversation with Doug in one of the columns took place a couple weeks ago where he said, you know, do you go see awards bait movies because you feel like you should? And I said, like, well, I kind of have a problem with the concept of awards bait because I do believe that, you know, even with this movie, I think everybody wanted to make a good movie.
Sure,
you know, they wanted to make the definitive version of this musical that's been around forever and people love it. Having said that, everything about it does feel engineered to like win Oscars, you know, which I guess is the definition of awards bait.
Right.
So, I thought the performances range somewhere from okay, if unexceptional, like Hugh Jackman and Amanda Seyfried, to downright bad. Like Russell Crowe.
They weren't given much to do.
With the exception of Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway has, you know, the one scene that everybody's talking about where she sings I Dreamed a Dream. Happens pretty early in the movie, and it's the best thing.
Does she sing that?
Yeah.
She does?
And it's the best thing in the movie, and then the movie's all downhill from there, and there's still about 2 hours left.
Oh, yeah, she does sing that. I remember now.
There are certain filmmakers whose every choice bothers you. You know, there's people who have an aversion to Quentin Tarantino. JB has talked before about his dislike of Darren Aronofsky, and so he goes to see Black Swan, and everything that Darren Aronofsky chooses to do in that movie makes him crazy.
I remember.
Tom Hooper might be my movie kryptonite, because every single thing he did, not only did I not like, but I actually thought it was bad and did a disservice to the movie, the way that he chooses to stage almost every single scene in the movie, I thought, was actively bad.
I felt like it was just filming a stage version. Like, I didn't really think it seemed like a movie. And I know that part of that is probably how the play is written. I have a cold. Does it sound like I have a cold?
Not to me, but
what about to the listeners?
Maybe. I can't hear them when they respond.
Oh, okay. Guys, can you hear me?
Okay, you wipe your nose and let me... I want you to finish your point.
Yes, but, I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
But I feel like... Tom Hooper went out of his way to not make it feel like a stage version of the movie. I understand what you're saying. And the movie that jumped in my head was Chicago. And I think I said to you while we were watching this, like, I know Chicago's not a great movie and probably didn't deserve its Best Picture Oscar for as much stock as you may put in that. But I feel like Chicago is very entertaining, and Chicago is very clever in the way that it chooses to sort of make itself cinematic.
Okay.
And in the way that it distinguishes the musical numbers from the sort of normal dialogue sequences.
Right.
And I know some of that's probably in the stage production. I've never seen the stage production of Chicago, but the way they're all sort of... Is it that way in the stage show where there are all these weird fantasies that take place in the characters' heads?
I think so.
Okay. See, I thought that was added for the movie, and I thought it really worked.
First time it never came out here.
Because when you say something like a film stage production, it's like it all takes place...
Like the camera was just like close-up, long shot. Close-up, well, long shot.
All
on
in close-ups.
Yes, yeah, so many. Stupid, like fisheye. Yeah, a lot of over-the-shoulder where it's just...
And he does this horrible fisheye lens, and everything's in close-up, and he's just following actors around as they shout songs. And then every once in a while, he decides to go big with some, like, bad CGI scene. And then there's sequences that I know are supposed to like have a big sense of scale, but he has no idea how to make that work because he's too busy just following around one person at a time.
Right.
So you go see it on stage and they have this huge barricade built and their two sides are shooting at each other. And it's like, this is amazing. This is happening on such a large scale.
Right.
But Tom Hooper's choice is to just film like a person at a time.
Right.
I feel like everything he does works against making this movie work at all.
And I have not seen it on stage. I don't dislike it, but I'm not a huge fan. I mean, I like some of the music, but I'm not this huge fan the way that a lot of people I know really, really love it. So I think that they're going to like it because if you really love material, especially when it comes down to music, you get to hear it and see it, and it's in a movie, and great. I think that people who love the show will love the movie just for that. Maybe some of them really do love the cinematic elements of it. My guess is that they're not going to be paying attention to any of that, and they're just going to be happy that they heard the song that they love, and that, you know, certain romantic scene or whatever.
Right.
I felt like the whole movie looked exactly the same. And again, maybe that is so intentional because it's, you know, hard times for these people. It's not like not a lot of happy things going on. So that's in the story. I guess he can't get away from that, but it just looked so flat and gray and brown.
Everything's dirty and gray.
Yeah, and I know that's, again, I know it's probably boring. A little bit intentional, but it didn't look like there was a lot of effort put into how the movie looked other than, you know,
and yet, period. I think there was a ton of effort, clothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, right, no, I know.
It's trying so hard, but at the same time...
must have been interesting on that, because didn't they sing...
live on camera.
Right.
As opposed to singing to
And I like that. We've talked
that's
about
the one,
that.
That's, yeah, like, that's the one thing about the movie that's kind of interesting because, especially in like the Anne Hathaway number, that works to the movie's advantage. Now, again, diehard fans of the show who listen to the Broadway cast recording over and over again.
Like diehard fans?
Like fans of Die Hard.
Yeah. We love Die Hard.
Me.
Okay.
I'm talking about myself. Okay. No, but people who are like, have the CD memorized and are used to that version, they may not like it because the actors don't have Broadway voices.
And I saw it on Broadway, and she did not sound as good.
Anne Hathaway does not hit all of the notes, but again, it's more about sort of the emotion behind the song than it is about the performance of the song.
And that's I like that a lot.
Again, in theory, I don't think it always works. I think that's the one thing that's the one time in the movie where it works.
Okay.
I thought it was a mess. It's a movie I pretty much never want to return to.
I don't think.
And again, neither of us are huge fans of musicals. Neither of us have seen the stage show, so there's our caveats out of the way.
Right.
You may love it. A lot of people love it.
I saw a high school production, and
I performed a medley from it in high school.
Right. Yeah, I did too.
Nice.
In junior high.
Well,
swing choir.
Mm-hmm. That's weird. It's kind of
well, and on my own, I think every girl is like given a copy of that at some point.
Definitely,
in her life,
fantasizes about being the one who sings that.
Yeah, right. She's supposed to listen to it and imagine that she's singing it. Right.
Anyway, let's talk. This is 40.
What?
the sort of sequel.
Okay, do we have to start in a certain spot, or can I start at the beginning?
Let's start at the beginning. I want to be wary of spoilers again. Let's not give major things away.
Have I given things away before?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But if we reach a point where we have to get into spoilers, we'll give you fair warning, listeners.
Okay. Should I not mention the big twist change that she has? Okay.
Yeah. Don't mention it.
Okay. Or Santa Claus.
Mention Santa Claus.
He gets sick.
Yeah.
Yeah. The movie opens.
Yes.
And actually, it's good. There's a little romantic. It's a hot scene going on.
Okay.
But can I say this? It's the very first scene.
I mean,
well, they get into like a little bit of an argument. I can just say that, right? Yes. They get into a little bit of an argument.
Right off the bat.
This is the very first scene. This is the first dialogue. And the argument bothers me. And I watched that scene a second time, and it still bothered me. I feel like it's not realistic. I feel it's like it's not how a couple who is used to communicating would be communicating. Maybe it's partly because, you know, she's turning 40 and he's turning 40, and so there's different emotions going on around that. I don't know. I'm not there yet, but I wasn't a fan of that argument, and the way that Leslie Mann performed it, I feel like turn a lot of people off from the entire movie. And later on, it's fine. It corrects itself in terms of that shrillness.
See, I think people are going into it ready to not like Leslie Mann. I think a lot of people have a problem with Leslie Mann, and I think part of it is because she tends to play that character.
Okay.
You know, she's probably best known for playing this exact same character in Knocked Up, where she is a little bit of the shrill character. And I had the same reaction, but we need to pull back a little bit because here's the...
Okay.
Well, here's the weird thing, obviously, is that Judd Apatow continues to make these very personal movies. And we did a podcast on Funny People a couple of years ago, Doug and I was fascinated by the way that Judd Apatow sort of cannibalized his own life for that movie, using old home movies that he had shot, casting his wife and children in the movie, casting his friends, and the way that that movie sort of commented on a lot of his career up to that point. This movie, I won't even say goes a step further, but certainly does the same thing in terms of, you know, casts his wife and kids again and is ostensibly about his life, even though I don't know that it is necessarily. But here's what I want to say.
Okay.
Because I have the same problem as you, right?
Okay.
My immediate reaction is, oh, she is harsh and shrill and off-putting.
Yeah.
She's the buzzkill.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so immediately she becomes the villain in the scene.
Right.
But that's not fair. Right.
Right. No, right.
Because why do we automatically side with Paul Rudd? Obviously, it's because we like Paul Rudd.
Because Paul Rudd is awesome.
Right. Paul Rudd's great. But like, Judd Apatow's movies have been accused of being misogynistic before. Yeah. That it's all about a boys' club. And the women are always the sort of responsible taskmaster bitches. Right?
Right.
And this movie doesn't really stray from that. So I'm like, why does he keep writing these parts for women that are like this? And then I was like, well, maybe that's not fair. Right. Maybe it's not that she's written to be a shrill bitch. Maybe there really just are women like this, and maybe it's not fair to sort of contextualize her as the villain. Maybe she's just being a real person, and maybe we should see it more from her perspective, because maybe he's really writing Leslie Mann, in which case, like, that person does exist, and that's... But then is it just him writing a movie in which he gets to complain about his wife, you know? I don't know. Because, which isn't fair, because the movie certainly is making the argument that, like, Paul Rudd needs to grow up and Leslie Mann needs to lighten up.
Right.
And that's the major conflict of their marriage, I would say.
Okay.
But I had the same feeling as you, and it comes up again and again
in the
movie. Yes,
right away.
Yes, and there's another scene.
I reacted to it, I think, more so from the position of, oh, I don't want other people who maybe haven't seen or, you know, like all his movies or don't like these actors or characters as much. I don't want them to be turned off immediately and then not be open to the many different, you know, dynamics and issues and everything that happens between their relationship. And
there's another scene later on where he's like farting in bed, and it starts and it's kind of funny because he farts and it's funny, but she immediately like turns on a dime and gets super annoyed with him. And it's like, you want to be like, hey, lighten up, let the guy fart in bed. But again, she's made to be the villain in that scene because boys will be boys, and isn't what he's doing cute and funny, and what she's doing is trying to stop the fun. And so we're, like, against her, but maybe that's not fair. I'm trying so hard to, like, be open-minded. But let's kind of give a general sense, if people are still listening at this point, of what we thought of the movie.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Why wouldn't they be listening at this point?
Well, I'm just
saying,
guys,
don't give up.
Because some people, when they see that it's on a movie that they haven't seen, they don't listen until they see the movie, which is fair.
Right.
I'm hoping that people listen to this even if they haven't seen it to try and make up their mind as to whether or not they should.
So you were asking me if I liked it?
Basically, yeah.
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Should we wrap up?
Yeah.
Okay.
I liked it. Decent.
Okay. Yeah. That's if you like Judd Apatow and his movies, there's a lot to like.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of writing style. It has the same kind of sense of humor. It has a lot of the same familiar faces.
It looks the same, like the sunshine. The light.
Right.
The
right.
Lighting,
definitely.
It just looks the same.
It sort of mixes comedy and drama in a way that not a lot of people are doing anymore.
Right.
Ever since James L. Brooks, like, really shit the bed. Like, Judd Apatow is clearly trying to pick up that mantle.
Right.
And I
like that. I tend to like that stuff.
Yeah, me too.
It makes me a person who...
So, like, while it was on, I was like, I'm having a fine time.
Right.
I'm enjoying this because I like these actors.
I like,
and
kind of being in this world a
exactly.
little bit. Yeah.
And it's very laid back and takes its time. Boy, does it.
I'm drinking wine.
Yeah, you are. To combat the cold. I like watching this group of people sort of bounce off each other and whatever. Having said that, if you are not a fan of Judd Apatow, you will not find anything in this movie that really corrects, I don't think, any of the problems that you've had with him. In fact, I feel like everything that is traditionally wrong with a Judd Apatow movie is, like, really on display here. So I feel like it's a good example of what he does really well, but I think it's also a really, I think it's a major case study of his flaws or his shortcomings as a filmmaker.
Okay.
I just think it's overly long. I think it has some tonal problems. I think there are long stretches where he falls in love with, some improvisation that his actors do.
Yes.
And so the movie just takes this...
The conversation between the trainer and the two women he's training definitely seemed like, oh, I bet they took 20 takes and just were making jokes up. And
there's a whole scene, maybe two-thirds of the way, and again, we're not getting into too many specifics, so I don't feel like this is a spoiler, but about two-thirds of the way through the movie, there's a pretty long scene where, like, Jason Segel and Chris O'Dowd both are trying to have sex with Megan Fox. And, like, it goes on for, like, a really long time.
Yeah.
None of these people are all that necessary to the plot. I mean, it's really just this detour where, like, Judd Apatow likes these actors. He likes this scene. As a deleted scene, I think it's fine. But it doesn't work in the movie because so many of his past movies that do this same sort of thing, which is that they take these sort of long improvisation-heavy detours. I feel like it's worked in the past because the movies are 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People. Anytime it happens in those movies, it's a group of guys sitting around busting each other's balls and trying to make each other laugh.
Okay, right.
And so that works because it's informing their relationships with one another.
Yes.
And in this movie, we really need to stay focused on, I want to say Dan and Debbie, but I don't think that's right. I forget what their names
are
in the movie. The movie really needs to be focused on them, and every time it takes one of these detours, I think it's a mistake. I think it's getting...
Okay.
I think it's unnecessary padding, and I think it's one of the things that is always wrong with his... Pete and Debbie, I'm sorry.
Pete and Debbie.
One of the things that's always wrong with his movies.
I feel like some of the dialogue is honest. And I think people in relationships, marriages, long-term, whatever, will appreciate some of it. But I hate it when a movie has to be a movie.
Yeah.
I guess so, totally unfair. But there's just certain things. Like, okay, in one scene, Paul Rudd takes off. Like, can't really say much else, but he takes off. And like, I don't know. In real life, does this happen? Does this happen?
Right.
I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe I'm boring.
Right, and it gets a little bit
people can get in arguments, people fight, they, you know, there are ups and downs, whatever, but I just don't think that these big grand scenes happen, so I wish sometimes that a movie would just leave that moviness out of it, and like, let's see what would really happen.
Sure. Do you feel like it was, and I'm not saying like that this is a commentary on our marriage or our relationship.
What are you going to say?
Yeah, right.
What? Merry Christmas.
Because I feel like a lot of the problems that these characters have, not just in their relationship, but just as people, are not ones that we share.
Right.
They seem really different.
Yes, can I comment on that?
Please do. That's what we're doing. Bless you on this.
Excuse me.
This podcast. That's really
Excuse
what we do.
Me.
We
I'm
comment
so
on
sorry.
Things and movies. You have a cold. You are forgiven.
I'm so sorry. Christmas cold.
Christmas sneeze.
Okay, what was I going to say? That
how they seem different.
Right. Well, and I'm sure a lot of people who are married, I mean, we're different. Everyone's different. Okay, but
No.
There's a scene.
Just leave it right there. Everyone's different. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, have a good one. Happy New Year.
Please think about that in 2013.
Everyone's different.
No more pull-ups.
How are you going to react?
Peace, fuckers.
Okay. Oh, my gosh.
That's war.
Can I talk about their jobs?
You don't have to ask permission every time.
Well, I'm worried that I'm going to have a spoiler.
Oh, you can talk about their jobs.
Okay.
I mean, some of that is...
Paul Rudd owns and runs a record label, right? A record label. There's a scene in the movie where he and Leslie Mann talk about music as if they've never talked about music. He likes this band, and she just doesn't get it, and I don't even know if she'd heard of it. And then she says, well, I like this music, and he can't stand it. And I'm like, there's no way. You've been married for how long? They were married for like 10 years,
yeah,
right?
Something. Well, probably longer, because the oldest daughter is in high school.
Yeah, but that was before they were married.
What?
What
are you saying?
It doesn't matter. That's okay.
Well, and I think I said that, too. That I think you made that point maybe the second time we were watching the movie, and I said that it's even less realistic, given the fact that he works... in the music industry.
Right.
So, of course they've talked about music, right? That's his job. It feels like a weird manufactured argument.
Right.
I don't know. And maybe, again, for all we know, it's an argument that Judd Apatow and Leslie Mann have in real life. And he just keeps...
Right. But do they... I mean, the way it comes across in the movie is as if they don't know each other's tastes in music.
Right.
And it's a new thing.
Right.
How could you like that? Or I don't like this.
So did you feel like it was an honest depiction of marriage?
At times, maybe like one third of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's hard. I don't know.
Well,
they have a very different lifestyle.
Well, yeah. And that's one of the things that the movie is getting some criticism for, because it's sort of about how hard these characters' lives are, or, you know, they're going through problems, part of it financial, but they appear to be well off or making choices that aren't really helping to improve the situation. Leslie Mann runs a clothing store that she sort of drops in on every once in a while, and some money is missing, and she's sort of concerned, but not. So, are we really supposed to worry about their financial hardships? And I guess in the current economic climate, it's hard to see people who are really rich act worried about money.
Right.
At the same time, something I always say is like, everyone's problems are real to those people. But also, you know, I don't want to bring up the Queen of Versailles, but we just watched a documentary called The Queen of Versailles about insanely rich people having money problems, and the problems are very real. So I don't think it's fair to dismiss, especially this movie, a work of fiction on those grounds.
Right. It's somebody's life. I'm sure somebody can relate to what they're going through.
Here's my issue with This Is 40. And again, when I watched it, it was fine because I like these people and I tend to like Judd Apatow movies enough. Although I worry, like, the jump from 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up to Funny People really felt like, wow, he's really reaching. He's really trying to grow as a filmmaker, because Funny People felt very ambitious to me. And it was like, holy shit, he's really trying something different. And I don't feel the same way with this. I worry that, like, we've seen what we're going to see from Judd Apatow. And I could be wrong, but I feel like he might be content to just do variations on what he's done already for the rest of his career. And, you know, plenty of filmmakers have had successful careers doing that, so whatever.
And I have to...
Go ahead.
I would totally watch it again. I would watch it right now if
it wasn't. It's definitely watchable, especially in, like, 15-minute chunks. A lot of his movies are great, like, 15 minutes at a time.
Right.
What was I saying? Oh, so here's the problem. I feel like the relationship between Pete and Debbie, right? I have their names?
Yeah.
Everything that Judd Apatow has to say about them and about their relationship, he said better and in a shorter amount of time in Knocked Up.
Oh, yeah.
In Knocked Up, there's a whole subplot about Paul Rudd secretly belonging to, like, a fantasy football league or a fantasy baseball league. It might be baseball. And so he always claims he's going out to work, but actually he's...
I forgot about that.
He's going to fantasy baseball, or at one point he goes to see Spider-Man 3, because all the characters in that movie are going to see Spider-Man 3, because it came out around the same time. And when they finally sort of have it out, Leslie Mann has this great line about, like, I want to see Spider-Man. Why didn't you go see it with me?
Right.
And I felt like that said everything that this movie takes well over 2 hours to say.
Right. I agree. And I want to go back to something you asked. If I thought it was a good depiction of married life, right? Or realistic?
Yes.
There's a scene where they go off for a weekend away, and as soon as they arrive at their destination, they were kind of, I think they were complaining about the kids. I don't know. And then they get there, and there's this line, they were complaining about the kids. And she says, oh, I feel bad. I love them. I miss them already. Should we go home? And that was so funny to me because I think a lot of parents can relate to that, you sort of sometimes look forward to, ooh, it's just the two of us getting away or whatever it is, you're going out one night or something, but you end up really, you miss your kids and you talk about cute things that they did and how much you love them or whatever. And then they have this weekend away and there's some funny stuff there. Probably not as much. I don't know if you liked it as much.
No.
I didn't think so because it involves things that you don't find funny.
Right.
But I don't know why.
Racism, basically, guys. I don't think it's funny.
I thought it was hilarious. No, I don't know. It's just Paul Rudd. It was funny. And then they go home, and as soon as they pull up, there's drama with the kids, and the one daughter has an ear infection. It goes right back into. And so part of me liked that because, again, that's life sometimes. That's real life, and you have to deal with it. But then part of me thought, oh, can't you give them a break just for a moment to show the other side of it.
The characters a break?
Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann. Their marriage, the characters, the stress of their lives at moment.
And that was part of, not my problem with the movie, but I feel like the movie a little bit goes out of its way to suggest that, like, the kids are the problem. And that's not true because they have other problems with honesty and there's other things going on in the movie. But the sequence that you're talking about, like, they're a different couple sort of when they're on their own. Mm-hmm. And then when they're back with the kids, it's like they have to go back to being this other way. And there's another scene where they're trying to be intimate and it gets interrupted. And that's partially because everything's pitched at just screaming.
Right,
and it's like, is that really what life is? Just there's four people shouting at each other at all times. I don't know. I know that Judd Apatow isn't making the case that, like, his own kids stand in the way of total happiness with his wife, because obviously he loves his kids and he puts them in the movie
cute.
And they're cute and they're great and whatever, but...
Gosh, they look, one looks like him, one looks like her.
Totally, yeah. So I know he's not making that argument, but I feel like if I were one of his kids watching the movie, and I'm sure they will, they're in it, that scene is very strange because it says, like, boy, when we're away from our kids, and they do say we miss them, but, like, we're so happy and
we have
great
a really
together.
Great time.
Yeah. And I know some of that is because they're away from responsibility and all that, you know?
Well, maybe that's an interesting point that I completely overlooked, that that when they're away and it's just the two of them, they get along great, they have so much fun. And as parents, they're different. So, like, as a couple away from kids, they are a certain style that kind of works. And then as parents together, their parenting styles don't match up. So then that causes a layer of...
Yeah, that's definitely true. But I mean, if the movie's bigger point is like, hey, life is sure easy when you're away from all your responsibility. Right. Like, that has nothing to do with being 40. That has nothing to do with being married. Right. That has nothing to do with even being a parent. Like, that's just true.
A line that I laughed at. And again, it's just Paul Rudd, I guess, his delivery. But they're having this family dinner outdoor in their gorgeous yard with this wonderful food. And yeah, okay. but they're having this great family dinner, or they're trying to have a good family dinner. And they tell the kids that they want to take away the Wi-Fi and that they're only going to use computers for like a half an hour a night. And the older daughter, who I think is 14, right? She's like a freshman in high school.
Yeah.
She starts freaking out. What are you talking about? How can you do this? The younger daughter takes her cell phone and has the app where the monkey looks like your child. I don't even know. but it's cute. It's funny.
It's in some and it of just the shows you. So yeah, it is. Really
right. No. But it shows you the difference. The kids, like, they are at very different ages. And there's another scene where there's a comment about play with your, or maybe it's that scene, play with your sister. And it's like, no, I don't want to play with her right now. They're not at that point. And the mom is trying to get them to like flash forward to think about when you're older and you have a sister you can count on. It's so great. But right now they don't match up. Their ages don't match up. Anyway, in that scene, they're suggesting things that the kids can do instead of just go on the internet or go on their phone or go on Facebook or whatever. And they suggest games like kick the can, look for a dead body, which I laughed, take a stitch. And then I think it's, Paul Rudd, who says, take a stick and push a tire down the street with it. And I laughed so hard because of his delivery. Oh, it was good. Anyway.
That was one of the things I did like about the movie. And again, the title is a little pretentious, and the ad campaign, which Judd Apatow, you know, can't be faulted for. But I just remember the first trailer coming out, and it was playing that We Are Young song.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, this is everyone's life. Like, I think the text actually says that. And again, that's a marketing department, whatever. But, like, that is disgusting.
well, in the title, this is 40. Not for everyone. And I don't mean, like, the problems. I just mean, again, it's hard, I think, in this economy for certain people to relate to some of what they go through. But that's totally unfair.
And I don't think the movie is really that much about, like, even being, I don't mean specifically 40, but even just like middle age. I mean, I understand it's about being married for a while and having kids that are a certain age. So maybe 40 summarizes all of that. I don't know. But it's also all sort of built around this 40th birthday party.
Right.
Where the movie really falls apart.
But, gosh, it does. I forgot about that scene.
Because it turns into a sitcom. It's just like, how do we end this movie? Oh.
There's a scene I can relate to.
Is it a spoiler to talk about it?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll do spoilers at the end, just for a couple minutes, to get some of this off our chest. but I did like that the movie does acknowledge some parenting concerns circa 2012.
Yes.
Where it's like, how do you raise a kid in the age of iPads and Facebook, where you have to worry about what the other kids are writing about your kid
24/7.
On Facebook? How much time do you let the kids spend with technology? Because we have much younger kids, but that's certainly something that we've talked about a lot already. Yeah, we don't want the kid who just needs to constantly have a screen in front of him or her.
Right.
And the movie does try and address that. I mean, it certainly doesn't come up with any answers or whatever. It doesn't need to, but at least it's realistic about, like, this is a concern now as a parent that didn't exist 10 or 20 years ago.
Right.
I don't know. But then there's a running thing about Lost, and it's just like, I don't know, that reference is already like 5 years out of date. I don't know.
Maybe it's because TV on your computer or your handheld device or whatever is like more common now, and so certain kids would catch up that way if they were into that.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Whatever, that's nitpicking.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we're talking about bigger issues that we have with the movie.
Some of the school scenes were interesting in terms of how parents deal with, like you were saying, internet, Facebook, what people are writing, and then the bullying aspect. And there's a scene where she sort of yells at a kid, and it made me nervous. I just felt like, no way can you yell at a kid, even if he deserved it. I feel like you just can't do that anymore.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
And I mean, any mom would want to if,
know. And maybe we're holding this movie to an impossible standard.
I know we are.
Because we want it to be absurd.
I apologize, audience. We're totally nitpicking. Like, this isn't exactly how life is all the time.
Exactly.
And I feel like we're so open-minded with everything else. Why are we...
We want it to be some sort of, like, documentary about what it's like to be married and a parent. But... But again, those scenes, and the movie's a comedy, so I guess they should be, but they're pitched at such a level that, like, they're played so broad and so for laughs. Melissa McCarthy shows up as that kid's mom, and again, it's a scene that's in a lot of the trailers.
Yeah.
And it's all just played for these big, big laughs. And maybe the scenes are funny. I don't know. If you think an adult yelling at a child is funny, you may love the scene. I don't know.
It makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I really liked Leslie Mann's performance in Knocked Up.
Okay.
I thought she had a really hard role to play, and I thought she did a good job of it because the role was that this woman has a really hard role to play in life. Like, she wants to be fun and irresponsible like Paul Rudd, but she can't be because one of them has to be the adult. And we get glimpses of
it. You made that point
everyone's...
before, and I thought it was really smart.
And in Knocked Up, I get a sense of that. Like, she goes out with Katherine Heigl, and they dance, and she wants to feel young again, and she wants to go see Spider-Man. She wants to be...
in this movie, too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we need to talk about that. Megan Fox, specifically. I was just about to get into the actors.
Okay.
And I won't say she's bad in this movie, because she's not bad at all. And I just... I remember being really impressed by her performance in Knocked Up, and in what was a supporting role.
Right.
And JB always says that he likes Leslie Mann as a character actress and not as a leading role. And maybe that's true. Maybe she does work better in a smaller part, because I feel like stretching it out to feature length does her no favors. Not the performance, the character, I think.
Right.
They both have parents, obviously. But we get to meet the fathers of both characters. We meet Paul Rudd's father, who's played by Albert Brooks. We meet Leslie Mann's father, who's played by John Lithgow. And it's sort of these very contrasting styles in parenting, and maybe it's supposed to suggest that this is why these people turned out the way they did. And it's obvious that Judd Apatow cast Albert Brooks because he's a huge Albert Brooks fan, and he was just so excited to have this guy that he's admired in his movie. But Albert Brooks is really, really great in the movie.
Yeah.
Anytime he's on screen, it's usually the best stuff in the movie.
Yeah.
He's so great. And Lithgow is fine, but given a role to play that I think is impossible and doesn't feel real in the way that so much of the movie wants to feel.
Right. Well, maybe he could have been directed a little bit differently, like to play it not so sternly.
Right. It's just like he's the stuffy, distant asshole.
Right. And he still could have been a stuffy, distant asshole without being so...
Like such a caricature of that.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. Maybe you don't cast John Lithgow because, like, that's what that
guy does.
Both the dads,
though, were on second wives.
Yes.
And had younger children, like young children. And I thought that was, I don't know, maybe a commentary on that's happening more and more.
Yeah. Stuff like that I really liked,
you know,
that makes it feel like, oh, this is about the world right now.
There's a day, right, yes. And that's why I feel like I can watch it again and again.
Sure.
Like, I don't mind, like you said, 15 minutes, if it was on TV, of course I'd just want to, like, leave it on.
Yeah.
There's a scene at the school where another mother walks by, and so I'm pretty sure it's the high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it the grade? No, it's, I don't know, whatever.
Oh, no, that was the grade
California,
school.
California, they're outside, it confuses me.
That was a grade school.
Okay, but another mother walks by, and she looks to be an older woman. She has, you know, long, flowing, beautiful hair.
Gray.
Yes, I was going to say with streaks of gray.
Oh,
and she's supposed to be an older woman, and she's pregnant.
Right.
So, again, sort of this commentary on we can do so many things in today's day and age that we weren't able to do before.
Right.
With that, with the technology, with relationships, marriages, divorces, everything.
Let's talk for a second about Megan Fox.
Okay.
The movie is populated by lots of familiar faces, especially if you're a Judd Apatow fan. So Chris O'Dowd from Bridesmaid shows up, and Jason Segel from Knocked Up and Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and Charlene Yee from Knocked Up, and Lena Dunham from Girls, which Judd Apatow produces, and there's some other people, one of the supporting roles that's obviously getting a lot of attention in the marketing is Megan Fox, who plays an employee at Leslie Mann's clothing store. And a lot of the marketing is built around her because she's shown in underwear and bathing suits in the movie, and so that's a way to sell your movie. There's a scene in which she tells Leslie Mann to feel her boobs to prove that they're real, and of course that ends up in a lot of, like, the marketing.
And that scene goes on for a while, in case you're wondering.
And so what is the function of that scene? Because textually it serves no purpose except for Leslie Mann to be like, oh, I was young and hot once, well, too,
I think that's what it's about. Right, only that, and I guess
but the length at which it goes on makes it seem to be about Judd Apatow getting his wife to touch Megan Fox's boobs, and it's a moment...
Well, that maybe he was brilliant.
Right, but it's, but it's a scene that only works if you look at it from that point of view, and then... If you are looking at it sort of from that perspective, to what end? You know, like, yeah, okay, he got her to touch boobs. Was it hot for him? And is that what this whole movie has been building to? Just this weird fantasy in which his wife touches Megan Fox's boobs?
Well,
I don't know.
Going back, though, to it being sort of this commentary on Leslie Mann saying, oh, I once, you know, she says, oh, I once had a better body right. and I once had this and that. So I guess, again, reminding us that this is what it is. Like, it's life. You change, you get older, and things get good, better, worse, whatever. I don't know.
But then she even, like, flat out says, like, the kids ruined her boobs. And it's another example of, like, kids ruin life.
Yeah, a lot of stuff with the kids. You're right.
Yeah.
I like our kids.
Me too. But now, I mean, who knows what's going to happen in a couple of years? They could turn into real a-holes who just want to watch Lost. So Megan Fox is in the movie. And I think I commented on this after we watched it.
Have you talked about Megan Fox on the podcast before?
I can't imagine that we ever have. Because I don't think she's ever been in a movie that we've discussed.
Really?
I don't think.
Didn't you?
Oh, we did a whole series on Jennifer's Body. We did like a three-part show on Jennifer's Body. because there was so much to unpack in that movie.
Right, oh yeah.
The feminist horror of Diablo Cody.
Multi-layered.
So, Megan Fox is in the movie, and... I get it, right? Because the character is supposed to be hot.
Impossibly hot.
Sure, yeah. And every character comments on the hotness of the Megan Fox character. But I just feel like, and I said this to you after we watched it, and it's probably not fair, but my reaction was just like, so does Judd Apatow just want to have sex with Megan Fox? Because why else is she cast in this movie? I understand, again, that, like, they want somebody who's hot. But I feel like there are so many actresses now that you could cast who are, quote-unquote, super hot or could be made up to look super hot who might have brought something additional to the character.
Right.
Because... Megan Fox doesn't bring anything except the way that she looks, and I'm not even a huge fan of that, but I don't want to, you know, it shouldn't be about that, right? I shouldn't just be weighing in on an actress's physical appearance, but, like, that's the whole reason for her being in the movie, so maybe it's fair.
Right.
But I just feel like she's not funny, she doesn't give a performance that's interesting or good or unique, she says the lines, and she's not, like, offensive, but she brings nothing to the movie. And the movie seems populated specifically by people that Judd Apatow sees will bring something.
Okay.
So Lena Dunham gets this little bit because, like, he sees something in her that she knows that she'll bring. And even Charlene Yee is an acquired taste. But, like, he knows what she's going to bring to the movie.
Right.
What does Megan Fox bring except her boobs?
Right. And her looks. And
Okay,
but here's... Maybe it was intentional. Maybe the fact that she doesn't bring anything else is the point. That he's saying, listen, a lot of men... at any age are going to notice her and look at her, but it doesn't mean that they necessarily want to be with her because it's just about the looks. I don't know. Maybe that's intentional because she doesn't have, although she, well, again, that's a spoiler. I can't say it.
We'll spend a couple minutes in spoilers in just about 2 more minutes. So stick with us for 2 more minutes. And then there's some things I want to say specifically about Megan Fox that would be considered spoilers. And, I just feel like if that's true, if that's really what he's going for, that does a disservice to his movie. Because I think he can make that same exact point by still casting an actress who brings something to the role, who would find laughs where there necessarily weren't obvious laughs, who could do something, who wouldn't just show up and be an empty shell as a commentary on being an empty shell, if that makes sense.
Okay, sure. Makes sense.
Okay. So now we're going to get into spoilers for the last couple minutes of our This Is 40 show. If you haven't seen it yet, and you're a Judd Apatow fan, you should see it. If you're not, I honestly think you could probably skip it. And again, I liked the movie enough.
I see everything.
Yeah, I do too. But I just, like, if you really have a problem with a lot of things he does, this movie will make you crazy.
Yeah, definitely.
This has everything that he does right and wrong.
Right, and otherwise, even though we really kind of nitpicked a lot of things in this movie, I feel like in the end, I would watch it again. I enjoyed being there.
But it's a mess.
It is. Yeah. There's a lot to nitpick, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating that he's so content to just make messes now. I mean, Finding People was a mess, but, like, it was a really interesting mess. I feel like this is much less of an interesting mess and more of just a mess.
I think you coined the term interesting mess.
I might have.
I really think if we go back into history...
Perhaps. All right, so let's talk about spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie, tune out now. Spoilers coming up in 3, 2, 1.
Okay, this is silly, but Leslie Mann, her relationship with her father, she goes out to lunch with him at one point, and he takes out, this isn't even a spoiler, I guess, I don't know, he takes out the pictures of his new kids, these young kids, and my daughter, she's a spitfire, a lot like you, actually, and my son, we went here, and here's pictures from our family vacation, and I felt a lot of sadness for Leslie Mann's character in that scene. Real sadness, because in real life, that happens, right? And so Leslie Mann is turning 40, but that doesn't mean that she is too old to feel the pain of the fact that her father basically left her and started a new family and had great memories and experiences with them and didn't really bother to, not include her, I don't mean literally include her, like invite her to go on vacation, but just to care about her livelihood and what she was doing. You know, there's just such a disconnect. And the scene at the party where they have the 40th birthday party, it's near the end of the movie. Everything kind of comes to a height there. And the father, I don't know, they get into like everyone's arguing.
Yeah.
And the father's going to leave and there's some harsh words. And I remember thinking that that was really unrealistic. Like, no one just freaks out like this at a party. I don't know. Don't people have poker faces or like, don't they just kind of suck it up till later?
The whole party scene was
crazy. It just out of control. Bad. Everyone, people start fighting and arguing. And that's the scene, right? Where Paul Rudd runs.
Yeah. He and then like gets in a bike accident.
Right. So then we need the hospital.
It's a real slapsticky, right.
To remind us of certain things.
Right. And John Lithgow has to step up and be like, well, I'll stay with the kids. And it's like, finally, he's being
this moment. He's caring. He's being a grandparent, too.
Now we change our minds about him.
It didn't feel real. And other scenes felt real. It felt real when he's showing his pictures and Leslie Mann is like, oh, look at his new family. I'm not a part of it.
The movie goes out of its way, as Judd Apatow seems to be directing his career, to combine what Billy Wilder referred to as the sour and the sweet, which he was so good at doing. And Judd Apatow clearly is trying to sort of model some of his movies after that.
I appreciate that. I appreciate someone's trying.
As do I. I just think when he gets to that last scene, he abandons doing that in order to turn it into a sitcom.
Okay.
To resolve certain things. And again, the whole movie is about...
Goofy bike ride, running away from
the
party.
But the movie is about, like, life is messy, life is complicated, life isn't easily resolved. So, to wrap it up in the last 10 minutes flies in the face of everything you've been saying. I'm going to go back to Megan Fox real quick, because here's the spoiler that I didn't want to give away. It is revealed at a certain point in the movie that the Megan Fox character is an escort.
I forgot about that.
And again, I don't want to accuse Judd Apatow's movies of being misogynistic, because I don't necessarily think that they are, but then I get to a scene like that, and I'm like, right. You're a pretty girl who's a whore.
Right, why can't she just be the pretty girl who works at the fashion store?
Right, and who maybe is vapid.
She knows a lot about fashion. They talk about how she's a big asset to the store. She sells the most clothes. She brings in the most business.
But she has to be asked to wear the clothes that they're selling.
Right.
And so, like, okay, that scene works. But really, that's just a setup to get her to change her clothes on camera so that Leslie Mann can touch her boobs so that Judd Apatow can go home and masturbate.
But there, this is also a spoiler.
Yeah.
Did I cut you off?
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Was the end of my thought.
Oh, okay, okay.
As it always usually is.
Right. Okay. Megan Fox.
Giant shark.
She is accused of stealing money from the store.
Yes.
And you might think for a second, like, oh, it's her, right? She's like super hot and young, and she's stealing money so she can, I don't remember what it was that she would have been. Doesn't someone say why she'd be stealing it?
Yeah, I forget.
Yeah, I forget.
Oh, because she is, like, driving a new car, and, like, there's some things that look suspicious.
Right, right. So when you find out that it's not her, yeah, it's disappointing that then she has to be an escort. Not criticizing the escort world.
How else would she afford those things?
Right, why can't she just
be... She's
a
whore.
But they already established that she was the best one. She made the most money in terms of commission. She sold the most clothes.
Right.
Why can't she just be good at that and also hot and not a slut or not a whore?
Right, or why couldn't it be that she says, like, I'm hot and men want to buy me things. And, like, okay, that's... I'm not saying that's being a whore, but, like...
Right.
Because men will do that, right? And so then the subtext there is like, well, yes, but that's because you have this going for you right now. But if that goes away, what will you have? And here's Leslie Mann, who is past that point and who now has responsibilities and kids and a house and who can't be the one who just has things bought for her and her life isn't as easy as, like, I'm hot, so buy me a car. And so maybe there's an interesting contrast there. But no, she's a hooker.
Well, at the party, it is... revealed that Megan Fox, like, knows the kids really well. She's, like, swimming with them in the pool. She comes out. She knows the two dad, the grandpas. She, like, seems to be a part of the family almost. And I get it. Maybe it was a small business, and so she's the boss.
There seems to be three employees.
Right, right. But I still don't feel like there'd be that familiarity within the family that she's, like, knows the grandpas that well. I don't know. It
and
just
then
seemed,
there's a 10-minute scene where Kristen
that's
Dowd
nitpicking.
And
I know,
Jason
but it seems like
try
such
to
a movie
with
thing.
Her, and it's like that scene to me is representative of so much of what's wrong with Judd Apatow. Just like this is an unnecessary detour at a point where you need to wrap things up.
But he just liked those characters riffing, right?
Right, but it's not interesting or even all that funny.
Right.
Like none of it is integral to the plot at all.
And if it was two different actors, it probably would be like horrible.
Sure, yeah.
Like,
no,
because those guys are so likable that you kind of like, you go along with it. You're like, yeah, I want to hear what they have to say.
I want to talk just very quickly about the very end of the movie and then we can get on with it. Or get on with it. By that, I mean get on with Christmas because it's almost over.
Get on with it.
So
many jokes.
The movie ends basically with Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann at a show, I think, for an artist that he's representing.
Okay.
I can't remember. Or no, they're just going to see a band live, maybe. Like, somebody gets tickets for them to go see a band. I don't even remember the band. Ryan Adams?
Yeah.
They just happen to be out seeing Ryan Adams.
Okay.
That's what it is. They're out seeing Ryan Adams.
Okay.
And Leslie Mann says, like, I like this. And he says, me too. And you think, look, they found some common ground. And
after all these years,
they're going to build from here. They found this band that they both like.
Right.
And things are going to work out. Because if they can agree on that, hell, they can agree on anything. Right? Fade to black. That's the end of your movie. No. Because this is a shitty Hollywood ending. And instead... she says, like, you should sign him. And Paul Rudd says, oh, yeah, I mean, I hear he's between labels. Well, why don't you go talk to him? And then, like, it fades to black. And it's a bad ending in six different ways. I mean, number one, because it feels forced on the movie because we have to know that they're going to be financially okay, that he's going to sign this artist, that his record label is going to succeed.
Right.
And so we don't have to leave the movie worrying about how are they going to pay the bills.
Is it worth it?
Right. It's literally, there's literally a big neon sign.
Yes,
that's
there
what
is.
She's referring to.
It was expensive.
Not the big neon sign that says, we're going to be okay.
that works too.
But also because there's nothing at all poetic about
how it's written,
not just about that, about that stupid little plot development, which isn't to say that them both agreeing that they like Ryan Adams is all that poetic, but again, at least it comments on something that's been going on throughout the movie. At least it makes sense to end at that point, to go on for those few extra beats to me. And endings are both the hardest and the easiest thing to get right.
Obviously, but I will say that I know you pretty well. You are really good at rewriting endings. And I don't mean like entire, you know, multiple scenes at the end of it. I mean like just the last minute of a movie, he sometimes, well, almost always, he'll say, oh, it should end there. Or if they would have just said that. And I know I sound biased and everyone will think I'm just saying this because I'm married to you. But I really feel like you are right every time. Like it, when
and
you
maybe
give me
I'm just right for
you
your
give me,
taste.
Well, maybe, right,
because
you know
we
me
have
so well.
Taste,
right. But you give me a new ending. And I think, yes, that would be so much better. So,
I tend to think they would be, too.
Is there a job for ending rewriter?
Just doing the endings.
Who can pay you to do that and make movies better? Is,
they're hard to
get. Who can pay you?
They're hard to get right. But at the same time, like, it's the thing that you need to get right. Because that's how you leave the theater.
Right.
And if you can get that last moment, I mean, there's plenty of movies that I've liked better just because they stuck the last few seconds. And conversely, there's plenty of movies that I walk out with a bad taste because they fuck up the ending.
Right, right,
and this movie fucks up the last week. Last week, God, you're such a Debbie. last week, JB and I talked about Hitchcock and the way that that movie ends. And it's like, here's your terrible ending, but okay, I'll take your terrible ending. But no, 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 you're going to go on for an extra beat that makes it 10 times worse.
Right.
And This Is 40 has some of that. It's like, I don't understand the rationale. I can't figure it out. Unless it really is just we have to know that the record label is going to succeed, which isn't what the movie has been about. The movie isn't about how can we get my business to work. The movie is about how can we get our marriage to work, and them agreeing that they like Ryan Adams speaks to that.
They're getting along.
Him going to sign Ryan Adams doesn't speak to that.
See, you're right. Listeners, right? Right?
Thank you.
There's a few left.
Listeners?
Yeah.
Who are still the three people who saw This Is 40 and are listening the week of Christmas?
Are also with a box of Kleenex just because they hear
are
it.
Crying?
Yes.
The thing is, listeners, you think she has a cold. She's very moved by this whole podcast.
I love it so much.
She's still thinking about Les Miserables because she wants a rip. Anyway, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you guys for listening. Remember, you can find us at fthismovie.net and email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Sorry I had a cold, guys, but it was really fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being
Merry
on the show.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas,
This is
Ben.
Just like a present.
This is 40.
You're my president.